issues from labor to services for seniors, services for kids, advocates for schools, advocates for the environment. We bring everybody together towards a common vision, a common mission, a common goal, and that's protecting what it is that makes Oregon great, a great place to live. And so we do that year in and year out. A lot of what we do is work on ballot measure issues, and that, you know, that can mean fighting against really, really bad ideas as well as helping to advance the good ones. And you know, in the case of what happened this year, you're absolutely right. We really were facing a horrible, not just one anti-worker ballot measure, but potentially two or more measures that were direct attacks on working families. And you have to think of the context in which this is taking place. You know, things, you know, for the last 30 years or more have become completely out of whack. All of the economic gains, the economic benefits are really being concentrated with very large corporations and the already wealthy. You know, right now, your listeners may know this or it may come as a shock to them, but corporate profits as a share of the economy have never been higher since they've been recorded. But by the same measure, by the share of the economy, wages and incomes for working people have almost never been lower. And those things aren't accidental. They're actually directly related. Corporate profits are so astronomically high because wages for working people have been, they've either stagnated or they've actually fallen in many cases. You know, since the end of the so-called end of the recession, in this period of economic recovery that we're in, things have actually gotten a lot worse for working people. While things are getting better for those at the very top, and that's also not an accident. This is the result of decades of policy decisions made by people in power, surrounded by well-heeled lobbyists for big corporate interests, and they have stacked the deck against working people. They have created a scenario in which things are great for those at the very top at the expense of the rest of us. And they do that by pushing legislation like anti-union, anti-worker legislation like we've seen around the country in a variety of states. In many cases, that happens through the legislature. But here in Oregon, because of our initiative system, big corporate interests are able to dump millions of dollars into an initiative and get something on the ballot, and then, of course, you know, run multi-million-dollar campaigns to pass them. So that's what we were facing. In 2014, there was a so-called right-to-work ballot measure that would have been on the ballot in November, and that won't be on the ballot. And that is great news, because that means that we won't have to have that fight in Oregon this year. That's the good news out of it. But as you mentioned, as part of the arrangement that keeps that off the ballot, we're also not going to be pursuing significant revenue initiatives this year as well.
Right, and that one of the things that interests me, I'll admit it, I'm a policy wonk and I'm a stat wonk. So I've known about OCPP down there in Silverton for many years, and actually contribute to that organization. These are the folks, for those who believe the truth shall set you free, this is the organization that gives us a lot of the information and a lot of the data about what's going on in Oregon. So Juan Carlos, what's your take on what's happening from the perspective of the Oregon Center on Public Policy?
Well, thank you, Michael, for inviting me to your show. It's great to be here. As you say, the Oregon Center for Public Policy, we look at the facts and try to, our slogan is, facts matter, and they matter when you're trying to craft good public policy that creates economic opportunity for all Oregonians. And what we're looking at right now is what Scott said. Right now, we are facing historic levels of income inequality. You can go back a century, and perhaps the only time that it's been higher was around 2007, right before the crash that was the Great Recession. You can go back even to the days of the right before the Great Depression. We're basically around those levels right now. It's possible that the most recent data that we have is about 2011. So it's possible that with the rising stock market and whatnot, we could be higher right now. But be as it may, we're at historic levels of income inequality. At the same time, our schools are are facing overcrowding. There's not enough teachers to go around. There's too many kids in a classroom. College tuition is increasingly unaffordable. So a lot of needs to invest in Oregonians that are not being met. Our revenue system is not generating enough revenue to invest in our people and have us move ahead and create economic opportunity.
So let me throw this out to either of you guys. The Oregon budget continues to go up. It really, in every two-year cycle, what are we, $17 billion now? Is that sound about right?
It's under that, but yeah. It's
a little bit under that, but we're moving in that direction. So the budget goes up, so the state does continue to spend money. And yet, what we're looking at, just my own example, at Portland Community College, tuition right now per credit is about $85. That makes it a two-year education that takes most students 3 or 4 years fairly expensive. When I started working there 22 years ago, it was about $35 a credit. So it has gone up 140% in 20 years. I mean, that's significant. That's a 7, 8, 9% a year increase. And that's because the amount of money the state provides has gone down. So if the state's spending more money and less money is winding up in the pockets of our colleges and universities and K-12. What is it? What's the message that we need to get out to people?
Sure. So a quick correction. The budget doesn't go up every year. In fact, during the recession when it hit, the general fund in the state budget actually fell pretty dramatically. And it has increased as the recovery as the lopsided recovery has happened. It has increased, but not close to the levels that we need in order to make up for what we lost during the recession. And so that's why we're seeing, it's why we're continuing to see a lack of state investment in higher ed. I think that's actually one of the clearest examples, or maybe one of the easiest illustrations of how decisions that are made by policymakers directly burden working families. Because the less money that the state invests in higher ed, and the state of Oregon invests as a percentage less in higher ed than all but four other states in the country, the costs are borne by those families who are trying to send their kids to school, trying to get the education that they need in order to be successful adults. I mean, this is the future of Oregon. This is the future of our kids' lives that we're talking about. And those costs are being borne. That means that either students are taking on more and more debt, or they're simply unable to attend. And there was a study that just came out this week that showed that the rising student debt load is one of the leading causes of the widening gap between the very, very rich and everyone else. Because that means that in middle class or working class kids who are getting out of college, they're facing a decade or more of crippling debt just to pay for this college education. And that is because the state, particularly in Oregon, the state has failed to invest in higher education at the levels we need.
And if I may add on that point about
on
the state budget, it's actually not the case that the state budget has been growing over time if you look at it from a constant measure. So if you look at the state budget as a percent of personal income, sort of the total income collected from Oregonians, over time, the state budget compared to the personal income has stayed relatively flat, has not fluctuates, some small percentage points up and down. But overall, it has basically stayed flat. So it's really not the case that the budget has grown. What is clear is that some parts of the budget have diminished over time. So for example, it's clear that our investments in higher education have dropped dramatically. If you go back two decades, the state, if you look at the cost of education at, say, Oregon, U of O, or one of the Oregon University System schools, the state used to pay about two-thirds of that cost of an education. Today, that has dropped to maybe about a fifth, a huge decline. And who's picking up the slack? Well, families and students.
No, I would add that there actually is one segment of the Oregon budget that's growing out of control. It grows by billions of dollars every 2 years. And that's the amount that the state spends on tax breaks.
Ah.
many of which go just to the very largest corporations or to the very, very wealthy. In fact, if you look at, you know, the Oregon's general fund budget, we spend about, in the last biennium, it's about $16 billion, and that's on our schools, prisons, healthcare, and basic, you know, the basic things that a state budget pays for. But the amount that we give away in tax breaks is more than $30 billion every 2 years. In fact, I think it's up to close to $36
billion. So let me remind our listeners that you are currently listening to KBOO FM 90.7. Thank you for listening. And that brings up a question for those who are kind of looking back a little bit when I first got here. What is different now versus the mid-70s with respect to where the Oregon budget comes from? Who's putting that money on the table, and who's paying more and who's paying less?
That's a big question to tackle in a short amount of time. But let me just give you one example. Let me give you one example of how things have changed since the 1970s. If you look at all state income taxes, all the income tax revenue collected by the state, if you go back to the mid 1970s, corporations used to contribute about 18% of that total, the rest being paid by Oregon families and individuals. If you fast forward to today, that contribution by corporations has declined to about 7%. So again, a dramatic decline. If you could flip the switch and take us back to that 18% contribution from corporations, we would have right there about $2 billion more. $2 billion more to invest in schools, higher ed, and a stronger safety net. So that's significant money.
And what are corporations doing with that extra money that they're getting and they're not being taxed for? Probably a whole other show.
Yeah, I mean that's definitely one of the factors that contributes to their record high profit levels. And what's happening with those? You know, those profits aren't being shared with workers. You know, as we talked about, the wages and incomes are flat or falling. Those profits, in many cases, are being shared with their already wealthy shareholders. So what you see is all of the income gains, particularly since the end of the recession, going to the top 1%. Because the increases in income that we've seen, in fact, we just got some data from the Department of Revenue for the state of Oregon for 2011 and 2012. This is inflation-adjusted numbers for full-year filers. I'm supposed to say that. It's very important. Between 2011 and 2012, income that's reported grew by $6 billion. That sounds great. That sounds like absolutely great news. Except when you dig into the numbers, you find out that 56% of that, so $3.4 billion, went just to the top 1%. So 16,000 filers in the state of Oregon pulled in 56% of all of the income gains for that year. In fact, if you look even further, we discover is that the increases in income didn't come from wages, doesn't come from salaries or tips or pensions. What it comes from is capital gains. So almost the entirety of the income increase came from people who have big investments in stocks.
Which the IRS ironically calls unearned income. And yet, there it checks appear in the mail. This is interesting. What is it exactly, thinking about initiatives that you folks didn't get on the ballot this time around, that are labeled with what we're calling tax fairness? Talk for a minute about what tax fairness looks like and what that would look like in Oregon.
Yeah, so in the state of Oregon, we to pay for our schools and healthcare, the basic services that we all depend on, we depend on the income tax more than just about any other state, because we don't have a sales tax, because property taxes at the county level are capped thanks to some ballot measures that happened in the 90s. So we depend more than many other states on income taxes. And what that means is that we have basically a flat income tax rate when you just look at the numbers. Most of our income for most of us is at about 9%, except that because of all the tax breaks that are available, particularly the tax breaks that are available to those at the very top, we actually have a tax system where the very wealthy pay a lower effective tax rate than than working people do, than middle class families do, than in every other category. And so we have a regressive tax system because of the built-in tax breaks that are available to those at the very top.
Regressive meaning that lower income people pay a higher percentage,
of their income.
Their income in taxes than higher income people.
Yeah. And so, you know, so that's one way to look at things. The other, you know, another way to look at it is what happens when we're not raising revenue sufficient to pay for the services that families depend on. What happens is that, you know, our middle class families are the ones who are bearing the cost of that. They're bearing the burden of that through fewer educational opportunities for their kids, for fewer health opportunities for senior citizens, you know, for many of the other health and social safety programs that we expect to be available in our communities that are just not being funded. Those effects are being felt by, you know, the vast majority of us, not those at the very top who are able to benefit from a low tax rate, dramatically increasing income, and they're sheltered from the negative effects of it.
So to simplify it for me, because I think in simple terms, the $50,000 debt load that a middle-income family and student attending the University of Oregon now has to take out to get that degree, a generation ago, they would not have had to take that out because the tax structure was set up in such a way that, that corporations were paying more, perhaps higher income people were paying more, and it seems like across the board, and this is where the OCPP comes in with all of their data gathering. I just finished reading Robert Reich's new book, and when his number one suggestion for how to fix things is to go back to pre-1980s tax rates. In fact, I heard at one time that during the Eisenhower administration, which folks will remember in the 1950s, was a period of greatest economic growth in the history of this country, almost any country in the world, the marginal tax rate, the tax rate above $1 million for folks, was something like 90%. And we were still doing fine. So, Juan Carlos, what do you folks have to say?
Well, I think that at the national level, that makes a lot of sense, going, say, if you could turn back the clock and go back 3-4 decades, higher tax rates, that would bring in the kind of revenue and it would do so in a fair way. I think at the state level, we face a different problem because tax rates haven't changed that much here. The problem is, Scott already alluded to it. The problem is, in many ways, all the tax subsidies, tax deductions, tax credits, the corporations and individuals have, especially wealthy individuals, have gotten to enjoy over the past few decades that have been put into our tax code and they basically leak revenue. Revenue dissipates and is not available for us to invest in our schools. So it's not an easy fix. That's the problem. I wish we could just say, go back to the tax rates of the 1970s and it's all fixed, but not so. There's so many, you would have to repeal each one separately unless you were to sort of just, for at least on the personal income side, cap all what they called itemized deductions. It's sort of, this was the actually a really good idea that Mitt Romney had in the last election, to cap itemized deductions. And the problem with his plan was that he started, I think, at 15,000 and then said, no, wait, maybe 25, oh no, maybe 40,000, and kept ratcheting it up. But the idea is sound. And that would be a way to sort of put a restraint on these tax deductions and whatnot that are costing us a lot of revenue, money that we could invest much more wisely.
If I may interrupt, I mean, even short of, you know, a full system-wide overhaul like what you're talking about, Juan Carlos, I mean, there are things that we can do to, you know, we could stop making things worse in a lot of ways, right? I mean, OCPP just had a report out about some corporations who are getting off the hook.
Yes, and actually, I'm glad you brought that point up, Scott, because our principle when it comes to addressing tax policy, the first principle ought to be do no harm. So first of all, stop giving tax breaks and reducing rates for those who have the ability to pay, the well-off and corporations who are doing very well in this economy. And we have to look at where the money is not coming in. So we just published a report showing that at least a two dozen corporations in Oregon paid no profitable corporations that turn a profit here in the state of Oregon, paid no income taxes in the year 2011. 8 of those corporations had profits in Oregon of over $5 million. So there's these tax loopholes are costing us a good bit of money.
Where can listeners find that report?
It's available on our website, ocpp.org. Listeners can also on our website sign up to receive our email updates and stay informed.
Great, thanks. All right. Anything else? And Scott, do you need to put in a plug for Our Oregon?
Yeah, please. Yes. Please. So if you go to OurOregon.org, you can actually see right up at the top right-hand corner, there's a handy link where you can sign up for updates from us. There's also one service that we do is we put out every weekday, we put out a daily news clip service where we go through all of the news headlines from around the state and compile the ones that we think are most important for telling this story. And we send them out to people who are interested in getting that. So you don't have to go through, you know, a dozen or more news outlets yourself. And you can sign up for that on the website. There's a handy little link that's just right on the right-hand side. One other thing you can do is connect with us on Facebook. And that's just facebook.com/OurOregon. And that's where we put a lot of the stuff up first.
I do get your condensed information. And it's wonderful every day, I guess, it pops up. And what you folks do is you go through all of the stories that are appearing in publications and the news media across the state and provide resources for that. And it's just, it's a nice way to tap into things. Well, we just got a couple of minutes left. What I would ask is in 25 words or fewer, unfair, I know, but if listeners out there are thinking this doesn't seem right, what can I do as just a citizen in Oregon in the next months or years? Any suggestions?
Yes, get to know your legislators very well. They have town halls and coffee events all the time. They talk to the same dozen people who show up at these things every time. Be one of those and go have some influence. We've crunched some numbers. If you look at who's paying to lobby the state, lobby legislators, corporations and corporate interests dwarf everyone else. So you need to be the squeaky wheel that goes and talks to people because they hear from lobbyists from big corporate interests all day long when they're in Salem. So make your voice heard.
Great. And, Juan Carlos.
And I would second that and add to it, ask your lawmakers, you know, please be, or tell them, please be sure to, first of all, do no harm. No, please, no more tax breaks for the well-off and corporations. And second of all, sort of the flip side of the coin is, let's raise revenue fairly by asking those with the greatest ability to pay to chip in more for the common good.
And I have to say, as someone who has done a lot of lobbying, it is very helpful, at least with most legislators, that when you talk to them, you go in armed with good information. And the organizations represented here by Juan Carlos Ordonez from Oregon Center for Public Policy and Scott Moore from Our Oregon, that's what these folks do. So I really hope the listeners will check out those websites, OurOregon.org and OCPP.org. And I thank you for listening. We'll be back in June. I wish Lane well, and I wish Tim well. And I would also like to say, as someone who grew up in the 60s and 70s in California and supported the grape and lettuce boycotts and changed my thinking from a very conservative white boy in the San Fernando Valley to a good progressive and a unionist, I have to thank Cesar Chavez, among others, for helping me do that. So Cesar, you are remembered. Si se puede. Thank you all. Have a good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
On Saturday, April 5th, KABU is proud to present A Night of Healing the Healthcare Blues at the 3rd Annual Inner City Blues Festival. It's a night of all-star performances at the Melody Ballroom, 615 Southeast Alder Street at 6 p.m. That's the Inner City Blues Festival, Saturday, April 5th at the Melody Ballroom from 6 to midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Hi, good evening. Adam Carpinelli here with Prison Pipeline Collective. And this evening we are talking with a Northwest regional activist here based in Seattle and with the Latino Advocacy Project. And how are you doing tonight? Can you just introduce yourself briefly?
Sure. Thank you for the invitation. My name is Maru Mora Villalpando. I live in Seattle, Washington. I've been here in this area for over 20 years, and I've been working on immigrant rights for the past 15 years. What we've been doing in the past 4 years is dedicating ourselves to get some kind of comprehensive immigration reform bill. And in the past 2 years, we realized that was not really the reality for many of us, that whatever kind of policy was coming down, it was just to perpetuate the deportation and criminalization of immigrants. So we have decided to switch and join the Not One More campaign to stop deportations. And that's what we're doing this year, devoting ourselves 100% of our time to stop deportations and demanding the Obama administration to do so through an executive order.
Great. Can you just start also with giving a brief rundown for anybody that's not familiar with what's happening in Tacoma? When did it start, and how has it been unfolding up until now?
Sure. Here in Tacoma, Washington, we have the Northwest Regional Detention Center. This center is one of over 20 centers around the nation that have a huge capacity to detain immigrants for civil proceedings. The detention center here in Tacoma has a capacity of nearly 1,600 people. And we, for many months, did a lot of research on deportations, how they happen, when they happen. And in February 24, we did a civil disobedience action where we stopped the traffic and we stopped buses from leaving with people to be deported. Based on that successful action, one of the people, or at least one of the so many people that didn't get deported and actually saw the action happening, when they went back into the detention center, this person told the rest of the people inside that what they have witnessed, that there were people outside supporting them, stopping deportations, stopping the vans, and yelling, yes, you're not alone, and yes, we're with you. So that inspired them to go on a hunger strike. Why a hunger strike? Because we have a huge population in there that are supposed to be in civil proceedings, but it seems like they're in a federal prison, which is sometimes worse because they don't even have a sentence. Most of the people there don't know how long will their processes will last. We have people that have been there for months, sometimes years, trying to get a hearing, sometimes trying to get a bond so they can pay and continue their civil proceeding outside, in the outside with their families. The conditions inside are terrible. This is a privately run detention center, as the vast majority of them across the nation. The group that manages this detention center is called Geo Group Incorporated. It's an international company that runs 98 facilities across the world. They not only charge the federal government between $120 to $160 per day per person, they also sell items in the detention center at a really extreme high price compared to the prices in the outside. They also offer something that they call the volunteer work program, which is you can work in the inside for $1 a day, and that way they save a lot of money. They don't hire regular employees. So pretty much the detention center is being run by the detainees themselves. And they also are treated as subhumans. The way they're called names, humiliated, In many instances, the medical services is also terrible. Sometimes they don't receive medical service. I mean, the stories are just horrific and really, really too many of them. So when this guy saw that people in direct outside care and care enough to stop deportations for the day, they saw that the only power they have was their own bodies, and they were put them to work. So they decided to go on a hunger strike. And on March 7, we got word that 1,200 people in the inside of the 1,300 that were at the moment decided to go on a hunger strike.
That's amazing. Can you mentioned, you know, the prisoners, and can we talk more about who are these folks? Where do they come from? What are their backgrounds?
The vast majority of them are Latinos. The vast majority of them are people of color. The vast majority of them are low-income immigrants. Supposedly, all of them are non-U.S. citizens, but there's been cases, isolated cases, but still there have been cases where even U.S. citizens have been taken into detention and even deported because of the color of their skin and because they couldn't prove they were U.S. citizens. There's a third of the population that are women. There's another third of the population that are people that are taken in the detention in during when they cross in the southern border. So they transfer people that just crossed the southern border to here, to Tacoma, Washington. And it's a shock for them because if they're released, they usually don't, they've never been here before. Their clothing doesn't match the weather here compared to crossing the border in the desert. Here it's really cold. The vast majority of them are not bilingual in English. And we have all sorts of different stories. People with no documentation that cross the border, people that